The scale model that we are looking at is rather exciting to me for a 15 or 16 year old to be doing. How'd this come about?
Well, it evolved from these developments that I continue to do. And each year I would develop my own car. Since the automobile companies were coming out with new models each year, I would come out with a new model each year, you know.
Only one, only two.
Right, well, except I call it the Champlain.
Oh, of course.
And I would work out new ideas. And, of course, during this time, I took the idea, which the airflow was quite, well, one of their major points was in moving the seats forward, which was also done in the Lincoln Zephyr. It was also done in the 35 Ford also. I think the 35 Ford moved the engine, can't recall for sure, either 5 or 8 inches forward, and or in effect move the wheels back that much.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, got the rear seat in front of the rear axle. Well, of course, I don't think they had the wheelbase in order to get it completely in front of the wheel, but the airflow and the Zephyr, I believe, did get the rear seat in front of the rear wheel. Anyway,
talk about the Chrysler airflow.
The Chrysler airflow.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I have done on this one. I have given it a longer wheelbase and got that rear wheel back so that the rear seat has full width.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say 66-inch seats front and rear. Mm-hmm. And so the model evolved from really out of this one that I call the 1938 version. I graduated from high school in 39. And so this model was developed, I suppose, as the 1939 version of my line of cars. And
how many models did the Champlain have before it was interrupted?
Well, the development of the model?
Mm-hmm.
I started this...
No, I was thinking in that terms. How many annual
oh,
models
well,
did you come out with?
Okay. The first one that I called Champlain was it says 1932. Which could have been like for a 1933 model.
Mm-hmm. So you continued that up to almost to the end of the decade, then.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's a full form model, except I do have a form or cover representing the rear fender, although it is very shallow, it's just an outline,
mm-hmm.
except for the turn under at the bottom. And I have a front fender which flows into the door.
Mm-hmm.
The unique features of this are really the rear end form, which comes to a point considerably above the bottom of the car. Mm-hmm. And
quite distinctive for the time.
Yeah, the back end then returns down towards the bottom of the car. So instead of having such a long tail as these cars had,
mm-hmm.
it shortened it and gave it a more modern, a more arrow
mm-hmm.
shape.
Chopped it.
It chopped it.
Yeah.
The front end, I know I had a different front end. I know in some of my sketches I have
mm-hmm.
the other front end, but somewhere along before I started the model, which was early 1939,
mm-hmm.
I changed the front end to this shape here, which has horizontal grille And this central theme that I had carried through with several of the other models,
mm-hmm.
and with separate fenders, the headlights built into the fenders.
But not flush in this case.
Not flush in this case. Mm-hmm. This, of course, was the time when sealed beams had come out.
Mm-hmm.
And so staying with the idea of the sealed beams, that's what I had put on it. I did, in the model, I did incorporate front wheels that would turn to give it the appearance of a little more life. And
even mobility.
Yeah, the tires, the wheels and tires, I turned myself. I went to a cabinet works and I knew the people there, so I made a drawing and wheels and tires and the hubcap, which really is what the tire is mounted to. It has a lot of detail.
Yes, it does.
And of course, I made three of them. The two front ones, the rear one is cut because you don't see the whole wheel.
Oh, man. Now, you said you carved this out of balsa wood.
Yeah. I ordered a block of balsa, and it's two pieces, really. It's cemented together along in this area. You can just faintly see a line here. So someplace there, it's glued together.
You accomplished the window frames.
Yes, the window frames are made out of copper wire and mm-hmm. soldered together and chrome plated.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, the grill was cut out of copper sheet
mm-hmm.
and chrome plated. And I've got brads soldered to those, and each one of those grill bars, there are one, two, three, four, five, four, six, eight grill bars on each side of the center. So there are 16 pieces there.
You sort of anticipated the massive grills that were to come a bit later.
I suppose.
Yes.
It's a low grill, which of course the Zephyr. Lincoln Zephyr of 1938 started that trend here in the United States.
Right.
And this, I am sure, was inspired by the Mercedes-Benz Grand Prix cars that came out with the first ones shortly before that, maybe 30, 36, 37. And Buick picked up on this then in 39.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is this type of thing, but this, of course, is quite different, but used somewhat similar to that.
Yeah.
In some cars. Anyway, it has a lot of form.
Yes, it does.
And although the body is quite wide, the whole car, even now, as you say, it doesn't look too bad, you know.
No, it looks very modern.
For almost 50 years later.
Yes, it does.
Where
would have been your trunk space? How would you manage that?
Well, it would have, I'm sure the drawing shows, but it had an opening.
Oh, I see.
That would have been in this area, below the window.
And your rear tire would have been?
Rear tire would have been on the bottom.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's on my layout someplace. The fact that the seats were forward gave quite a considerable amount of trunk space, even though it was short overhang. This, again, maybe is one of the reasons that it looks sort of modern, is that it does have a short rear overhang, which, of course, is the modern theme again. But it was not particularly low at that time. It had the theme. You know, I should have picked up from the cord the lower the frame built into the rails and the floor built down to the bottom of the frame.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the cord was front wheel drive. They didn't have to worry about a drive shaft. But back in those days, in the 30s and even 40s, they were attempting to not have a hump on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they built the floor above the frame and above the drive shaft generally. They'd have a rise or a little just a little step where the drive shaft was, mm-hmm. and to better accommodate center passengers. But, anyway, I did this model, and during the same period of time, I made these.
Was this a class project, or did you do it for spare time?
Well, I thought I would take advantage. I wanted to build a model anyway, and I was taking a. Let's see, what was it for? I did take art in my senior year, mm-hmm. and I did some fairly nice things. I wish I had taken it. I could have taken junior and senior. I could have taken drafting in high school, and I didn't do that either, and I should have done that. But they made such a effort to sell students, and this was something that was wrong, sell students on the idea of college preparatory courses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went along with them, but I shouldn't have. I should have taken individual courses. I should have taken art. I should have taken drafting, and I would have liked to have taken auto mechanics, and I could have taken more shop work, you know,
mm-hmm.
because these are things that I've worked with all my life also.
Right.
I think this was a project was done for, it was in chemistry, it was for a physics course. Had to make something.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to stretch it a bit, and I started this model. Well, there were other students that had put anywhere from 10 to 30 hours on a project, and at this point of time, I had were the drawings.
Oh.
And so I brought my drawings in. I had about 60 hours on the drawings already. Well, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't look like much to them.
Mm-hmm.
But.
You drew out a whole series of specification drawings?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The four view drawing, side elevation, top, front, and rear.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, from these, I made my templates from which I made my model. But I think the model, I had probably about 500 hours, as I recall.
Wow.
So it had, you know, quite a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was that.
You did your own carving?
Maybe it was 200. Maybe it was 200 hours. I did my own carving. I did have a fellow paint it for me.
I had started about the paint used.
I had started the paint, and I wasn't happy with it, so I gave it to a fellow, and he sprayed it with enamel, which wasn't the best, but maybe in the long run it's been good because it stood up.
Beautifully preserved.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's a good preservation.
Mm-hmm.
If it had been, I was going to use airplane lacquer. I had a friend that made airplane models, and he did a beautiful job of finishing, but I don't know how it would have stood up.
Mm-hmm.
And this has stood up. I've got to give him credit for that.
What type of paint was it?
It was an enamel.
Enamel.
Well, at the same period of time, this was finished, of course. I suppose I finished it doing odd jobs. I got out of high school. Of course, my only interest was automobile design. And my brother had gone to Art Center in the fall of 37.
Was that then in Los Angeles?
It was in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And they had moved into three or four places there. Their present location, a quite extensive premises there, the school they have, is at least their third, or maybe their fourth. Anyway, I think my brother was in the original location, and it was a small place. But he worked with some of the, took courses from some of the top photographers back before the war, and many that were quite famous after the war. And it was a very good school at that time. They had one instructor, a fellow by the name of Coleman, Bill Coleman. He periodically would work at General Motors Design, Art and Color, and he would teach out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he had maybe been married and had been divorced. Anyway, I had met him soon after I came to Ford. And so he sort of helped me, you know. Mm-hmm. He taught me how to do airbrush work. And
where did you have this instruction?
Well, at his place, at his apartment. Okay. But he was working at GM Art and Color at that time.
Oh, I'm sorry, but
this was a later period of time.
Later period of time. Yeah. Okay.
Well, okay, let's go back before. During 1940, I started, and I suppose maybe even in 39, I started these drawings. I don't know what time they were, and I don't know for sure which one came first. I think the first one may have been this LaSalle, because I was really enamored by the LaSalle. So I think this was probably my first one. It was probably done sometime in early 1940.
Can you describe that in the audio?
Well, of course, it had the LaSalle theme. A vertical center grill, and this had five grill bars surrounded by the sheet metal opening, which came to a small radius and ran from the bottom to the top of the hood. Narrow, very narrow grill, and then it had horizontal grill bars coming from the side of this central nacelle, coming onto a single fender shape that has the appearance of flowing through the central fuselage, like a wing almost.
Mm-hmm.
And the headlights are similar to the headlights on this model. And the rest of the shape is similar to the shape on this model, except it is a convertible.
Mm-hmm.
But there you can get the idea of the full width rear of the full width seats.
Oh yes, right. Still an innovation at that time.
Yes, very much so.
I remember being precariously perched on those in the back seat of somebody's car on the edge of those seats.
Right. Well, this was a Cadillac. My theme for a Cadillac. Mm-hmm. By the way, 1940 was the last year they built the LaSalle.
That's right.
The Cadillac, I had horizontal grill bars and a low grill coming to quite a definite V shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I had smaller grills running from the side of the central portion of the hood out to the headlights. And this was a grill opening. And then behind that, theme line running down the side of the car, coming into a small vent, or perhaps it was really the parking lights. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was probably the parking lights.
And what have you done to you brought the headlights in a little more flush, haven't you?
Yes, the headlights appear to be somewhat more flush and more set into the fenders, and they run right into the side of the hood.
Mm-hmm. Reminiscent of some later models.
Yeah, the Packard was a theme. Of course, it carried the Packard grill theme, but in a more narrow grill,
mm-hmm.
but with a lot of form. It had a curve in the side and flowing back down underneath the front of the car.
They did that about 10 years later.
Yes, that's true. And some small louvers at the side of the grill in the central nacelle that comes out from the fenders.
Just facilitate airflow.
Right. The hood has a lot of form to it, and it flows down to the grill and flows, which the grill then follows that shape on down. The body shape, again, is really the shape of this model.
Mm-hmm. That was to stay with you for some time, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's the thing I was sort of pushing, I guess.
Distinctive.
This fourth one represents what I call an Oldsmobile. It's a convertible and quite different. It had a theme similar to what Olds themes were at that time, so it could be recognized as an Olds. It had a bumper that was rather unusual, and it was a formed sheet which was covered with rubber on the leading faces, with a central area that was depressed for a license plate. So this was somewhat
ahead of its time. It came along about 10 or 15 years later.
The way the bumper is formed, it became a Z section and would have had some flexibility or resilient section movement to it if you bump something.
Yeah.
So you not only be protected by the rubber shape, but the bumper itself would have some give to it.
And some absorption power.
Right. Yeah. The body comes to has quite a bit of form and comes to quite a nice flowing down turn at the back, and flowing under also at the back. And so it has a very streamlined form. The front fender flows and disappears into the door. Mm. The body shape comes forward and forms the shape for the headlight. The hood disappears at the cowl.
Interesting.
Well, anyway, I had these four drawings.
This was in effect your first portfolio.
First portfolio. And I brought these drawings and the model to Detroit.
And you'd now graduated from high school.
I had graduated from high school. I had wanted to go to art school. I didn't have the means to do so.
Your older brother went instead.
Yeah.
Often the case.
Yes, that's true. It was this disturbing period of time. The war, of course, had started in Europe in the fall of 39. And so things were rather difficult. My counselor when I was in high school had recommended that I should go to Western Reserve and take up engineering, which would have probably been a good thing to have done.
Mm-hmm.
My desire was to go to art school, and of course I didn't do either. I didn't know I could draw,
mm-hmm.
And I had built this model.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow in Findlay, I've forgotten his name, except that I do know that somehow I learned of him, and he had worked for a while. He was an artist. He had worked for a while at GM Art and Color, which they called their design operation at that
time. That was the Harley Earl.
Harley Earl's original organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I had met him, I suppose, in 38, 39, along in there sometime, 40. Maybe, I don't think it was that late. I think it was 38, 39. So he had given me somewhat of a kind of rundown of what the places were like, what they paid.
Mm-hmm.
What you should ask for when you go in, this sort of thing.
Was he a freelance?
Yes, he was a freelance artist at that time.
Did Earl employ freelance artists from time to time?
He would try anybody, you know.
Pardon?
He would try anybody at that time.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So anyway, I had enough confidence and I guess you could say adventuresome to come to Detroit. I had a family friend, a fellow that I had known in high school. I graduated with him. I had not known him before high school. But anyway, his father was an automobile salesman. And he moved to Detroit, I think, like in January of 1941. And so I had made a deal with him that I was going to come up and go with him around the auto companies. So that's what I did. I came up to Detroit in April of 1941. But before that time, let's complete this. I was doing various things. I had worked in a lunch counter of a drugstore. Then I got into there was a photographer that came to town, and advertised, as they still do. They'll go around and they'll publish a special offer in the newspaper, you know, get so many pictures, get one free or whatever. So anyway, this was in the fall, it must have been in the fall of 39. And my brother was a photographer, and he was working with another photographer in town who I think at that point was had become ill. And so they were taking pictures, and they had to have these developed and processed. And I think my brother was doing some of this, or maybe doing it for them. I can't recall. Doing some of it anyway. They're overload, I suppose. And so I was doing the retouching for them. And then they went home over the holidays to, I think, Rochester, New York. Anyway, so I sort of watched their operation while they were gone. While they were doing that, I know I was drawing one of those models. when things weren't busy, you know.
Sure.
And it wasn't very busy. But anyway, a friend I had known from church, was a meat cutter. And for several years, my grandmother had two brothers out in Iowa that had a meat market. And we would, lots of times in the summer, take a trip out there. And I would help out in this meat market.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of interesting stories about that. In 1934, I guess it was, my dad's aunt lived in Chicago, and her son and daughter, they lived together. And he was an engineer on the railroad, and his father had been an engineer. And his father had run a train from, I guess maybe either Buffalo or Rochester, down to Porgeville, Letchworth Park.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he had met his wife, who was my dad's aunt, and she was helping out in this hotel up on top of the hill there by this big bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so they were living in Chicago. So we would visit them once in a while. We visited in 34 and went to the 1934 World, or the Century of Progress Fair.
You remember seeing the prototype for the Lincoln Zephyr?
I remember a lot of these things. I don't remember all of the things, you know, but I do remember being very excited about seeing the fair and all of the things there. And yes, the prototype for the Zephyr was there, and also
it's called the Car of Tomorrow.
Yeah, right. It was rear engine, I believe. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Briggs development.
Tom Charda. John Charda. TJARDA.
Right. And also Cadillac had a very special and famous V16 Cadillac model in their display. Anyway, there was many things there, and it was an exciting time. But in Murray, Iowa, which was just a small town in Iowa, farming community, these two brothers of my grandmother had this meat market. So I would help out there in the meat market. And we went there several summers. And across the street from his shop was a series of open lots. And at the back of these lots, the Burlington Railway went.
Yeah.
And with a nice curve right in the middle of this town. And every afternoon at 5 o'clock the Burlington Zephyr.
Right. Yes. Oh, what a sight that must have been. Did it stop?
No.
It went right on through.
Whatever it was going, 90 miles an hour, 100 or whatever, you know, and it was just zoom through.
Did you know? Have you ever seen the famous photograph of the Lincoln Zephyr being posed against the Burlington Zephyr?
Someplace, yes, I've got a copy of that someplace. Yeah, I suppose one of my books. Mm. Yeah, it was quite a sight to see that.
Must have been.
Silver stainless steel cars. And,
that was a Bud creation, wasn't it?
That was Bud, right?
Bud Company.
The big grill on it.
Yes.
Or no, they had the grill up above, didn't they?
That's right.
Yeah, the tall front end. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's sort of a side issue.
For a young, would-be designer.
Yeah, these things.
Sure. They all have their influence.
They all have a very great influence, you know, really. Yeah. Well, anyway, so this there was a new, the first, what you could call, supermarket opened up in Findlay, and this fellow was going to head up the meat market. And, of course, I was maybe working on my drawings and doing some of these other things. And I guess I wasn't working at that time. So I said, well, if you need some help, and this would have been in the spring of 1940. I said, if you need some help, I've had a little bit of experience in my uncle's meat market. I know a little bit about it. And so give me a ring. So it opened. And he called me up about noon, and he says, can you come over and give us a hand? I went over there, and this was like a couple of blocks away. Well, this friend called me and to come over and give him a hand. So I went over, and the people were standing, oh, like 10 deep. It was just jammed with people.
Was this the novelty of the supermarket?
I guess so. A new, something all new,
mm-hmm.
and quite different. And the meat market was like a similar Farmer Jack's or whatever, you know. They had a very nice vegetable and fruit area and a big grocery area and a separate meat area, all in one large building. They had knocked down, they bought three stores, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So got the partitions and built this area in. Mm-hmm. So it was an all new thing. And they had special prices, of course, too, and it advertised this.
Opening day specials.
Yeah, like selling bologna at, I don't know, maybe 10 cents a pound. And steak was, I know at that time, was like, I don't know, perhaps 35 cents a pound. And butter maybe, I don't know, 40, 45 cents. Anyway. So I remember working there that day until like midnight. Ooh. So I worked there for several months. But during that period of time...
You were a meat cutter, huh?
Well, I learned meat cutting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I took care of, I guess, their cold meats, trays and so forth, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
And one of the things that made the store popular was that they would be open until midnight.
Ooh.
Or 11 o'clock, something.
Really?
Or 11 o'clock, and Saturday night, maybe midnight. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever worked in a store, grocery store, you know that you clean up
mm-hmm.
after the store is closed. And the meat market on a Saturday night, after they close, you wash down all your coolers,
mm-hmm.
Take everything out of your cabinets, you put it in your major cooler, and clean everything up. So you never get out until like 1:30 or so in the morning.
Clean all the slicers and influence.
You had to clean everything. So it's spotless. So anyway, during that period of time, the New York World's Fair was on, 1939, 1940.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the 1940 World's Fair. Of course, Ford at that time had their Continental
mm-hmm.
there on display.
Yes.
And their various other cars, of course, the 40 models.
Mm-hmm.
And GM had this really outstanding display of the world of tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I have a catalog of that,
too,
by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It was very influential display all of these things for a young fellow like myself, and of course I had quite an influence. So anyway,
you probably didn't know too much about the time. You realized later that was designed by Norman Bell Geddes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, I have his one of his books too.
And by the way, you probably know a very young Gil Spear.
Did he work on that?
He was an assistant to Geddes.
Oh, he was. Yeah. That I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Uh huh. Well, anyway. So I stayed there at that place until, I guess, the fall. Until the first of the year. Sometime around the first of the year. And the fellow who had run the meat market left there and went to A&P. And so I followed him there a few weeks later. So it must have been late in the fall.
What happened to that fledgling supermarket chain?
Well, they ran for a good many years there, and
did they expand?
Well, they opened up a couple of others,
mm-hmm.
and in some of the other towns around there, I think eventually he probably sold out.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because what happened was that A&P opened one.
Not too far away.
Not too far away, okay. And then other companies came in. But he was there with that, I suppose, up into the 50s anyway.
Hmm.
I went to A&P and worked for the same meat cutter. Again, he was a friend. He and his wife, I've known his wife all of my life because she and her family were members of our church, and he became a member of our church, so I had known her, you know, as a girl in Sunday school, although she was maybe a couple years older than I, or maybe she was the age of my brother, could
be. What denomination was it?
It's called the Church of God, and they call this, since there are other churches called Churches of God, they call this the General Conference of the Churches of God,
mm-hmm.
Of which since about 1972, perhaps, I've been on the board of the seminary in Findlay. So I'm still on the board of the seminary. It's a small seminary, but it serves the denomination. Findlay College is also the college of that denomination.
Oh, is it?
Uh-huh. And the seminary has been separated from the college since 62, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they built their own buildings, and they're in the process of expanding, and a lot of effort. They have not been accredited, so we've been going through a period of accreditation
mm-hmm.
now for the last few years, and hope to be fully accredited in the next year. Well, anyway, I've always been a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I was baptized, which I don't remember, of course, when I was a few days old, a week old, something. But I've always known the church, and this has had a major influence and a stabilizing control of my life. I've never had problems of
That's
real
good.
Consequence.
Yeah.
Likewise, my family has always been Christians, and my wife and I, my wife is a Christian, and so our family is all Christian. And it has had a major effect on the way we have lived. But anyway, during the first quarter of 1941, I was there at the A&P working under this fellow, and he was a real marketing man. He knew how to sell things, and he showed me how to prepare. I had the fish case, and the area where the A&P was a rather strong Catholic area. Finley had a Catholic church, and they had a fair-sized Catholic community. And we would get our fish in on a Thursday, load up that fish case right up to the top, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some very good variety of fish, and fresh fish, which had been shipped in ice as well as frozen.
Mm-hmm.
It was as good as any of the fish markets you see right today.
Mm-hmm.
And so during the first quarter of 1941, it wasn't me, I was looking under this fellow's direction, but the A&P, the local division, area division, which included Toledo and all of northwest Ohio, that store sold more fish and increased their sales of fish more than any other store in that division, which is rather interesting. Side issue.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, just about the end of that quarter, of course, I left and said, well, I got my model finished and had the drawings,
mm-hmm.
so I'm going to Detroit. So
and this gentleman had encouraged you to go to Detroit?
Yes, he had moved to Detroit. He lived down off of Livernois, and his father was a used car salesman in one of the used car lots on Livernois.
Mm-hmm.
So my folks brought me up on a Wednesday. And they left me off there with mm-hmm. my things. And
first time you've gone to Chicago, New York, so you were used to a big city.
Yes.
Perhaps not to live in.
Not to live in, but my dad had become quite ill. He had the flu, the World War I post-war flu, and he became quite ill. And the doctor had, he overcame this. The doctor had recommended that he should go up to northern Michigan and go fishing. So this was in 1924, and he bought a Chevrolet, four-door Chevy, four-cylinder, and with the flu, he had also, his father had died and his brother had died that same year. And I can vaguely remember some of these things, you know, I was 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember that trip up north.
Mm-hmm.
It took us parts of 3 days. We left like late morning one day.
Mm-hmm.
We picked up my aunt and cousin. They had one child, his brother that had died. And I remember stopping in Bowling Green and getting gas and checking the tires. And I think we stopped overnight someplace like in Adrian and stopped the second night probably in around Cadillac. The next day we went to Green Lake, which is by Interlaken.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and we
well.
Had a cottage there. There's some
lovely
people,
area.
People there from Findlay that had a cottage. So we stayed in this cottage for a week. And so every summer after that,
I guess Maddie had just about started his camp about that time, 24, hadn't he?
It was very new
yeah,
at that
separate.
Time, very
yeah.
new.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they did have the music thing going at that mm-hmm. time, I remember. The next year we went back and we camped. We pitched a tent on Duck Lake, which was the other lake.
Right.
And it was right by the buildings there, and I know Dad would go in and buy a pie from them, you know.
Sure.
And we would fish in the lake.
Mm.
So every year after that, we would take a trip and camp someplace.
Mm. Great
and
fun.
Yeah, Dad had built on one side of the car, the right side of the car, a running board box that was the height of the running board, so you could open the doors. And this would open up and carry all sorts of things. On the front of that, at the fender, a vertical box that had a fold-down cover, which would become a table.
Yeah.
And keep all of our food stuff in there, you know. On the other side, he built a an ice box, which mounted on the fender, so we could carry all of our things that needed to be cooled. And we'd get a block of ice. This was the other thing back in those days. You'd come into a town and you'd look for an ice house.
Sure.
And you could always tell an ice house. It was near a lake or pond and maybe a sawmill.
Yeah.
because I needed the sawdust.
Right.
And it had the siding on the inside of the tuifores,
mm-hmm.
the wall construction.
Yeah. Insulation.
So you would look for ice house and get a block of ice to fill that. And then on the running board, on the left side, had one of these running board carriers. We had our tent,
mm-hmm.
and all of our things. And we had a trunk on the back of the car, too, of course, we carried things. But we'd have our whole thing. We camped all over the country. He had come from New York State, of course, so and had relatives in Pennsylvania. So we had lots of times go there and camp and fish and up in New England. And, of course, many times up in Michigan and up in Canada several times. And this was back when there were roads were not much. There were these washboard roads, you know,
yeah.
And you'd have a speed limit of 35 and you'd be fortunate if you could go 35. And maps really didn't amount to much, or they were non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have some road signs, so you'd go from town to town. That's the way you'd travel. And particularly in the East, I don't know if you traveled even in 1940, when we went to the World's Fair, we went on up to Moosehead Lake up in Maine and fished and stayed in a cottage up there. But the East was always very poorly marked, the roads, and you could get lost very easily. In 1934, when we went to Chicago and saw the World's Fair, we went on out to Colorado.
Did you?
My grandmother was the oldest, one of the older children in the family, and she married and, of course, stayed there in Portageville, and her family moved west, I think probably to Iowa,
mm-hmm.
and then some of them went on west beyond that. So we went to Colorado and stayed with family every night in some place along the way.
Wonderful.
And she had a sister near Greeley, Colorado, that she hadn't seen for 32 years, and another one across the divide near Crawford County, near Delta County, near Crawford, one or the other, she hadn't seen for one sister 37 years, and the other sister 52 years, because the family was separated, you know. Well, anyway, these were all of the background to my
marvelous
coming
experience.
I had traveled a lot, and I had a lot of experience with cars. I'd seen a lot of cars, you know, and
you probably had to do a lot of mechanic. You and your father had fixed the car a lot.
Sure,
I
had learned mechanical things, you know, at least to some extent, and to the extent that I needed. So anyway, I came up and on a Wednesday and stayed with this fellow. So Thursday morning we came out to the engineering lab, and I carried my model in my case, and
mm-hmm.
I had my drawing and some sort of a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And went in, and a fellow by the name of Frank Francis, who was E.T. Gregory's secretary, actually, at that time.
Frank Francis.
He had gone through a trade school, and he's one of the fellows I want to give you name and address.
Yes.
I need to write these down, but you might like to talk with him, because he was with Gregory for some period of time,
mm-hmm.
before the war as his secretary, so it might be interesting.
Very much so.
He retired a few years ago, but I think he's still around someplace. And he took my model and my drawings and took them in and showed them apparently to Gregory and the others, and came back out and asked me to come back on Monday. Well, folks had just brought me up on Wednesday. You know, Friday, I guess this other fellow who had come from Findlay, and I took the bus back to Findlay. So I'd only been gone 2 days, you know. He was anxious to see Findlay.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend was in Findlay, so I was anxious to see her. So we went back to Findlay and came back on the bus then on a Sunday. And so I went out again on Monday and took my model and my drawings back out. So they looked at them again and came out and said, well, we'd like to hire you, and we'd like you to give me the form to go down to the employment office.
At this time, had you met Mr. Gregory?
I don't think I'd met them. I hadn't been interviewed, actually, except through this fellow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was sort of green. I didn't know
really
what to do. And so anyway, they gave me this form. Of course, they didn't know much about me walking in off the street. I
mm-hmm.
hadn't gone to school, self-taught. So anyway, I went down to the employment office on a Tuesday, and this was shortly after their big strike in 41.
Right. Yeah. It just
finished. So it was kind of a rough area.
Where was the employment office? Down at the Rouge?
It was down at the Rouge off of Miller Road.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know whether it's still there or not.
I think it may be. Yeah.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a rough area for...
Were you driving at the time or were you taking a streetcar?
No, I had to take a bus.
So the buses?
They had noise, especially during that bus time. They had good bus service. They had streetcars. Well, the streetcars may have run all the way through Dearborn. I'm not sure at that time. Shortly after that, the streetcars ended at Greenfield.
Ah, okay.
And I'd, for some time, until I had a car, I'd take a bus to Findlay and back, and I'd come in late. And I'd come in late, too late, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I'd take the streetcar to the end of the line, which was Greenfield, and I'd either hike or hitchhike if I was
sure.
later than the last bus.
Right.
Lots of times I'd catch the bus out to West Dearborn here. But anyway, I was hired in, and I went back out to the lab and was ushered in, got my badge,
mm-hmm.
and of course this was really tremendous.
Sure.
First time inside of a design studio.
It was in the south end of that.
It was in the south end
of the
lab.
The engineering laboratory.
Yes. They had maple floors, is what we've got here.
Mm, yeah.
They
still have that marvelous mahogany row.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
It very
right.
impressive when you first saw it.
Oh yeah. They had, I think, maybe three bays and a partition across, a wood partition.
Mm-hmm.
It went up, you know, maybe 10 feet, something like this. 8 feet, maybe only. And they had a full operation there. They had a nice wood and metal shop. They had, principally, their modelers were ex-plaster model makers.
Mm-hmm. Which is still
artisans.
The preferred mode at that time.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
right. It was sort of the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Decorative plaster work.
Right.
They had a lot of young modelers who were really students out of the trade school. And very few of them went on to become modelers. But, you know, they got people in there to work on these models.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being led by... Dick Benike.
Spell that, please.
And,
can you spell Mr. Benike's name?
Yeah, I'll get it for you.
He was the head modeler at the time?
He was the head modeler. They had, a couple of other older fellows. But they had some full-size models going, and they were on the full-size models. They had a couple of Italians that were pretty good, really. One of them was quite good. I had to think about their anyway, I was put on a model with, I expected to go on a board. Anyway, they put me on a model. Mm-hmm. I brought the model.
Ah, and that interesting. Made it
interesting. Sure, you know, it was a good model.
Sure. Yeah.
And as good as anything that they made there.
Right.
And the interesting thing, which I never knew until the luncheon of my retirement, John Major was one of the fellows that talked a little bit at my retirement, and mm-hmm. he said when I came, he felt, and they felt, that for the first time they had a real modeler, somebody that understood form. So, of course, I didn't know this, but I didn't have any difficulty working in clay, and it didn't take me long. I had to get a set of tools, so I went down to Lewis Art Supply and bought some tools and sharpened them, and worked on some of these scale models. At that time, Ford was doing quarter scale, and they were using green clay, and they were getting their clay from Chavant.
Which
is the major supplier now, of course. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I worked on some of these scale models. And then there was a fellow by the name of Leverins, Bill Leverins, who was also a plaster, a decorative plaster model maker. And
Chavant is spelled Chavant.
Correct.
And that was in Red Bank, New Jersey.
That's correct.
Yeah.
At that time, they were in New Jersey, and it was being ran by a lady, the wife of the founder of that company, which it was founded, I think, in about 1890 or so. And they were building clay from a French recipe. And they had they made plastiline, and they also made this styling clay, which is a harder clay.
What was that word you just...
Plastiline?
How do you spell that?
I'll get you all these things.
I need it for the transcription, yeah.
Well, you always ask me these things when I... plastiline, P-L-A-S-T-L-I-N-E,
I
think.
That's good. Okay.
Yeah.
Forgive me if I interrupt this point. Can you fill us in at this point? This is 1941, right?
1941. There was like 47 people working there.
Fine. For students of modeling, how long had clay been used in the automotive design business?
Well, clay, if you've read the various articles, Harley Earl made the first automobile clay model on the clay bank of a stream up in the hills of California back in 1914.
That early.
But
using domestic clay right from the ground.
He had used clay in the 20s in some of his developments. Mm-hmm. Actual styling clay.
In his coach building.
Yes.
Days.
And so when he started Art and Color, he was using clay there. And of course, by that time, the various industrial design firms were using clay.
Oh, were they?
On a small scale.
But previous to that, automobile styling had been largely plaster.
Plaster.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is not as easy to work with, obviously.
And wax. They use wax to some extent for ornaments.
Oh, yes.
And they may have used clay on some minor things, you know, like developing the shape of their radiator core, the shell.
Mm-hmm.
These were the most ornate part of a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
They designated the marquee. They told what vehicle that was. So
right.
There was some clay being used, but on a very limited scale up until the 30s.
So it was really Earl who pioneered the use of it in full body.
I believe so.
Prototypes.
Yes, I believe so. So there were, at that time, there were maybe a half a dozen, when I hired in, a half a dozen quarter scale models being developed for what would have been like the 1943 model.
Mm-hmm.
The
42 was already set.
42 was already set at that point. And 41s, of course, were in production at that point. And, well, I worked on a couple of those for, some period of time, maybe 2-3 months. Well, I was there 6 weeks and I got my first raise. which was, you know, a substantial raise. By that time, they had some understanding of what I could do, I suppose. And I was put on hood ornaments, and I worked with this fellow, Bill Leverins. And one of the major things he had responsibility for was the Fox Theater. If you've ever been in the Fox, the plaster work on that. And he had a marvelous library of historical settings and dress. I don't know whatever happened to that. I was quite close with him until, well, he retired, I guess, while I was in Germany. One way we were in Germany, and I came back, and I was so involved with things before that I should have been closer to him at that time. But so I don't know what happened to these things. It would be interesting. He's died a good many years ago by now. But so I did several hood ornaments, and you know, they were nice. They were here. You could set and work on these things, and I learned to model with both hands, and I could do detail work. But to me, it was simple, and I always had a good eye for line and form, and so I did some interesting things with him. And then I started in on a full-size model.
Did any of your models become, well, of course, you were working on 43, so
yes,
never really came to fruition.
Not at that time. I started working with Bill Wagner and
Willis P. Wagner.
Willis P. Wagner and the designer, artist, I'll think of a minute. Anyway, we did this model, and I think I've shown you pictures of that, a full-size development, which was to have been 43.
Size clay would have been the 43 model.
Yeah, this was a full-size development.